Therapy Chat Podcast, episode 155.
This is the Therapy Chat Podcast with Laura Reagan, LCSWC. The information shared in this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health professional. And now, here's your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC.
Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. Today, I am really happy to be bringing you another interview that was so powerful for me to record because it resonated so closely with the work I do with my clients. I think the author you're going to hear from is doing incredible work in helping therapists and the general public understand how trauma and attachment can impact someone's ability to connect in relationship and including receiving help in therapy. My guest today is a Canadian psychologist, Dr. Robert T. Muller. Robert T. Muller, PhD, is author of the award-winning psychotherapy bestseller, Trauma and the Avoidant Client, as well as numerous articles on trauma, attachment, and psychotherapy. Dr. Muller is a professor of clinical psychology at York University and a fellow of the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation. Dr. Muller is a lead investigator on several multi-site programs to treat interpersonal trauma. He's an international speaker, and he has been in practice for over 30 years, and he currently practices in downtown Toronto. This conversation is one of my favorites, although there have been so many wonderful conversations I've had over the time I've been making this podcast. It's hard to say that, but it resonated so deeply for me. And I've been recommending his book to every therapist I talk to or work with. And really, the book is for the general public. So this is a book that you can read if you have experienced trauma or have attachment issues, or if you're a therapist working with people who have those concerns. Of course, as therapists, we all have our own histories as well. You know, we have an attachment style too. So it's relevant on many levels. So without any more time, let's go ahead and get started listening to my interview with Dr. Robert T. Muller.
Try Therapy Notes, the number one rated electronic health record system available today. With live telephone support 7 days a week, it's clear why Therapy Notes is rated 4.9 out of 5 stars on Trustpilot and has a 5-star rating on Google. Therapy Notes makes billing, scheduling, note-taking, and telehealth incredibly easy. And now for all you prescribers out there, Therapy Notes is proudly introducing ePrescribe. Try it today with no strings attached and see why everyone is switching to Therapy Notes, now featuring ePrescribe. You can get 2 months free by using promo code CHAT at therapynotes.com. Trauma Therapist Network is a website to learn about trauma and how it shows up in our lives and to find a trauma therapist. Go to traumatherapistnetwork.com to find a trauma therapist near you today.
Are you going through menopause or perimenopause? It can be a struggle to find comfort in your body with night sweats, hot flashes, and so many other uncomfortable symptoms. Hormone Harmony is a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause, created by Happy Mammoth. They are dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout women's lives. So Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time. For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code CHAT at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code CHAT for 15% off today.
Catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.
Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. Today, I have a super fascinating guest to bring to you. I'm talking today with Dr. Robert T. Mueller, who is a professor of clinical psychology, a fellow of ISSTD, researcher and therapist, and the author of the best-selling book, Trauma and the Avoidant Client, and the new book, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up. Robert, thank you so much for being on Therapy Chat today.
Oh, I'm so excited. Really, really happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes, I'm so happy too. Let's just start off for anybody who isn't familiar with you. If you could just tell our audience about yourself and your work.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm a clinical psychologist and my work has been in trauma for many years since I was a grad student. So that's going back to, I think I graduated in 1993, I think. And, so it goes back to then. And, I've been working, with trauma clients as well as, research questions in the area. And, over the last few years, I've been really focusing on the issues that I've written about in my book. So first, about 12 years ago, I began really getting interested in the issue of avoidance and how people avoid talking about or dealing with their traumatic past. And then in my second book, I took that issue and expanded upon it, really focused on how the therapy relationship is such a key to people being able to get better from trauma. And to go from a place where they really do avoid talking about and thinking about their traumatic past to a point where they can, through the course of a psychotherapy relationship, be able to face and integrate some of the difficulties that up to that point were just so overwhelming to them and continue to act upon them and affect their lives. So that's what I've been really interested in the last few years.
That's so beautiful. And, you know, when we think about avoidance, sometimes we feel as if it's something that people are doing deliberately. But of course, you know, there are many reasons that someone may not be able to face what happened to them or to think about it or to feel the emotions that go along with that experience or to trust us as therapists to be able to hold that.
100%. Yep, that's right. That's right.
So are you willing to share a little bit about your own story around the unspoken traumatic experiences families hold and how it is for children growing up in that kind of family environment?
Yeah, for sure. Let me just say, respond to the first part of your question or what you had mentioned before about avoidance, and that is that 100% I agree with you that this is not something that's, quote, you know, something people are doing deliberately. It becomes an automatic thing. And where we really see this, and I talk about this in Trauma and Struggle to Open Up, the idea of family secrets, how people come to a place where family secrecy and then also family loyalty, so being loyal to one's family, the way that things were done and the things that were spoken and the things were not spoken about, these become what people come to see as certainly as requirements. I mean, it's part of the family, but then also survival strategies. And it's very frightening to think of doing something different when this is the way that it was done in your family. And I'm happy to share. So avoidance is very often related to this kind of, you know, so avoidance of talking about traumatic events often becomes something that families do. And again, it's automatic. It can be shameful. It can be embarrassing, you know, and when people do at some point talk about their traumatic experiences, they can get a heck of a lot of resistance from their family members. In therapy, we often see in the same family, one child, you know, an adult child, let's say, who talks about some abusive event that happened with a relative, let's say, and then the other sibling, you know, their brother or their sister, who says, you know, either that their sibling is lying, or they say, I don't remember that, or what are you talking about? I remember, you know, our family was, you know, and they say the exact opposite, experiencing things really, really differently. And we see this sort of difference in the extent to which people are willing to be open or closed off about family secrets. And I'm happy to share a little bit about my personal, have I still got you there? Sometimes I talk on and on, but am I okay?
No,
here?
No, yeah, you're still okay. Right. And right. I love you what you said. Okay. So thank you so much. Yes.
No problem. So that's just kind of a little bit of the sort of maybe whatever theoretical or background or what we see as therapists. In my own family, yeah. This in my family, I grew up as a child of Holocaust survivors, but my parents, they weren't adults during the Holocaust. They were children during the Holocaust. So it's really interesting, and you know, it was of course terribly, terribly difficult for them to be children during the Holocaust. My mother was hidden and separated from her family, and she was very lucky. So both my parents are Jewish. I'm Jewish. And so it was a life-threatening situation for my parents in Hungary. They grew up in Budapest, Hungary, both my parents. And during the last year of World War II, I think in the late 40s, it was a very particularly the most dangerous time for Jews in Hungary. My mother was separated from her family and hidden by a Christian woman who took a huge risk. I mean, she risked her life. My father was, his mother was taken away. His father had been already taken away, but then his mother was taken away by the Hungarian Nazi party, the Arrow Cross, they were called. And they took my father's mother away. And so my father and his sister were left on their own. And his uncle and his aunt, who the aunt happened to be Christian. So my father was also Jewish, but this Christian woman had married into the family and again took enormous risks and in a number of ways saved my father's life, got him papers that were false papers that he needed in order to be able to be in Budapest. And now in my particular family, these particular stories, which were, you know, both my parents, it's very hard for them to talk about this stuff. I mean, this is not easy stuff for them to talk about. They were separated from their families. My mom, she was about 6 years old, 6 or 7, and she was separated from her parents for months and was terrified. So it was really a scary, scary situation for little kids. In many ways, I feel like my parents, I mean, my way of understanding it is that they lost, you know, they faced really a lost childhood. Both of my parents really lost what it meant at that point to be a kid. They grew up very quickly and experienced things that no children should ever experience. And that was a huge trauma for them, losing, in a sense, losing their child. They didn't, you know, my mom's parents remained alive. My father's father was killed. And that was a huge loss for him as well, of course. So they went through a hell of a lot, my parents. And in my family, we did talk about stories about the Holocaust, But the family that my parents left behind, who remained in Hungary, so my parents were immigrants in 1956, after the failed Hungarian Revolution, came over to Canada, where they happened to get visas. And at this point, they were adults. And their families that they left behind, especially my father's family that he left behind, never talked about the war. They never talked about the Holocaust. They never talked about their Jewish past. It was a secret. And some of them, of course, they've kept the secret till today. And it's interesting, ironically, in Hungary, there's been a reemergence of anti-Semitism. But I've seen my own family, how family secrecy, you know, it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, it can be life-saving. At times, people really need to keep secrets. And, you know, for example, had my mother not kept the secret that she was Jewish when she was a 6 or 7 year old girl from anybody who asked her, she would have been killed. That's a tough thing to do as a little kid, to keep a secret. I mean, little kids are notoriously terrible at keeping secrets.
Yeah.
So you know, somehow, I don't know how my mother did it, but she did, even as a little kid. So she did manage to keep the secret then, and that was life-saving. But my parents did talk about the Holocaust, but my family in Hungary did not, and they've kept the secret till today. And it's really interesting to see within my own family these very different ways of reacting to these traumatic events, you know, whether you keep it a secret or not.
Yeah, there's so many metaphors in that too, how the culture basically required them to keep it a secret, and still, you know, after that time, culturally, it was kind of like better for them if they did.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. After the, you know, after my parents left Hungary, it was the heyday of, I mean, it was an Eastern Bloc country, Hungary. And so they certainly didn't talk about being Jewish, the family that was left behind.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, took on a very different identity. Much of the family took on, you know, we're proud communists was the thing that many of them took on. And much to my dad's chagrin, my dad is a business guy. And, you know, so he was not too happy about that. But the family that he'd left behind in Hungary, yeah, they took on this sort of we're communists. And that was kind of an identity that they found. And certainly being Jewish was the last thing that they ever wanted to admit to anybody.
Yeah, so it was somewhat of a survival strategy to take on that new identity as well. And I just think about how, you know, there's like a parallel between that and when there's abuse in families, and how our culture encourages people not to talk about abuse. And, you know, just so many things about kind of like collective responses to traumatic things that reinforce the smaller systems keeping that secrecy as well. And, you know, it goes from being a survival strategy that's protective to, like so many things with trauma, something that harms the people who are, or at least some of the people who are in that situation.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I mean, you know, people learn their lessons well, and, you know, what worked as a childhood survival strategy is what people hold on to. And then as adults, they continue to, and even though it may get them into a lot of trouble in relationships, you know, what did work at one point and made sense at one point, now in relationships becomes a huge burden. And, you know, we see this when people carry trauma into intimate relationships, where the struggle is with vulnerability. I mean, trauma, you know, the reason for secrecy is very clear. It keeps it holds vulnerability at bay. You know, it's a survival strategy. But then, in order to really be engaged in a romantic relationship, in a sexual relationship, and think about what you need in order to be vulnerable enough to have a satisfying sex life, you have to be willing to let go of control to some extent. You know, not entirely, but to some extent, you have to be willing to ease up a little bit on on how much you control everything. And that's hard. That's hard for people who have trauma history. Is it scary? And it's just really, really tough. And so many of them struggle with that. Many struggle in the parenting context, because that's another place where to be able to be playful with your children, to be able to form a relationship with your children, an authentic relationship, also means being willing to ease up a bit on control, to be able to be a little bit vulnerable, to be able to, you know, as your children are teenagers, to be able to be honest with them about certain things that you went through as a teenager, certain struggles. And teenagers really respect that in parents, when their parents are able to say, yeah, you know, you're having trouble with your boyfriend or girlfriend. Yeah, I mean, I remember I had, sort of mm-hmm. sharing a little bit. I mean, that's just a really nice, it can be a great moment between parents and kids, but that's hard when you're parenting with the burden of a trauma history, because that idea of feeling vulnerable, it's scary, it's dangerous. It's hard to do. So there are many contexts where just kind of there's a revisiting of the past when you're faced with those things.
Yeah, this is so rich for me, because I hear so many of the struggles that my clients have, and that, you know, I and the people I love have, in different ways, with vulnerability and, you know, just control and all of the barriers to emotional intimacy, physical intimacy, that unwillingness to be vulnerable because of traumatic past really has. I was just talking about this with a consultation group I was in right before we started our interview. And in fact, I told them all about your book, and they all wrote it down and said they were going to get it. So you'll see four new sales today, at least. Like you're counting like with an abacus or something. But no, I mean, this is just really, really resonant for the experiences that I hear my clients sharing about, and that certainly I see and feel in my own life. And one of the things you talk about in the book that I thought was what I love, one of the things I really love about your book, is that you made explicit a lot of things that I know so many of my clients and people I know feel, but it's not always spoken explicitly. So I love how you talked about those dynamics that are often kind of hard to put into words.
Yeah, it was hard. It was hard for me to put some of them into words. It was a writing challenge, because some of these things are so emotional mm-hmm. that words are limited in how you describe it. So I tried. I mean,
I think you did a wonderful job with that.
Thanks. Thanks. But yeah, there were certainly, and I wanted to make explicit some of the things that some, you know, therapists who've been doing this, been around the block a few times with these kinds of clients, know to be true, but don't necessarily show up in explicitly in books on trauma therapy.
Yes.
One example is this idea of taking the client's suffering seriously. And I talk about that in the context of a particular case, and I've changed the identifying information so this made the specifics anonymous, but this was a person who had a loss, and what I talked about was the idea that some losses, some traumatic events, the client themselves really struggles to take seriously and mm-hmm. doesn't feel they have the right to take seriously. And so, you know, you've got those clients who come in and say, okay, this is what happened to me and I need help with trauma therapy. But then you have those clients who come in and they don't call it trauma therapy at all or anything. Mm-hmm. They certainly won't even use the word trauma. They'll just say, I don't know what's wrong with me. And in this particular case, this happened to be a client whose dog had died, and she couldn't get it. Why am I making such a big deal out of it? She would say to herself, you know, and there was a struggle she had to take her suffering seriously. And the piece that I wanted to kind of outline in that case was how for her to be able to reach a point where she could take her suffering seriously and begin to actually do the work of grieving the loss. I mean, mm-hmm. indeed, even being able to call it a loss, you know, other than just why am I making a big deal out of this kind of thing, I had to reach a point where I really, you know, both took her suffering seriously and helped her find a way to really connect to the loss. And that was the relational piece. But this is a concept, this taking the client's suffering seriously, that you might say, well, of course you need to do that. I mean, no kidding. But what I talk about in my book is all the times where there are various reasons why that, you know, our own issues get in the way of doing that. And we don't realize that our own issues get in the way. And, you know, even our wish to fix people or make people better, our wish to, you know, sometimes managed care puts pressure on us. You have to fix this person already. Why aren't they better? You know, mm-hmm. there are all kinds of very real pressures that tell us, you know, we have to speed up. We have to speed up when what we have to sort of do in trauma therapy is slow down, listen, yes. be patient, and take the suffering seriously. And then actually the work can happen much, much, much faster. But we don't realize always that we're doing it. And so this was kind of through this story, I wanted to give an example where I, you know, I fell into that exact trap. You know, I mean, I kind of where I was fumbling along and kind of how did I kind of work my way out of it? What did I have to connect to help me work my way out of it? And then the client could work their way out of it. And so then she was able to move on. So, yeah, I mean, that's something that I really was sort of trying to make explicit.
Yes. And another one that you brought up was self-deception. And, you know, I thought about like the family mythology, like you hear these stories of the same stories repeated about what your childhood or your sibling's childhood was like. In my family, we have a couple of so-called funny stories. You know, everyone laughs the whole time the story's being told, but they both involve, strangely, don't ask me why in my family this happened more than once, but a child being hit over the head with a hatchet by another child.
Wow.
And, you know, of course, both times the child in question, who wasn't me, wasn't permanently injured or killed, thank God. But, you know, how that story can be told and retold as like a part of our family mythology as a funny thing. Like, wow, it was just the craziest thing, you know? And it's like, no, that's a horrible thing. And it doesn't give the child the chance to own the way it really was for them. You know, it's more told as it was just a funny story. And that I think really can contribute to that self-deception where you talked about in your book, one person who told how close he was with his mom and how she tried to abort him as yeah. with laughter.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it is. It's, once, I mean, that particular story and your story, I've heard this so much from both clients, as well as when I've done, you know, workshops on this, therapists who say, yeah, you know, I really connect to that. Laughter, and it's so fundamental because mm-hmm. laughter is a great coping strategy. Laughter is the best medicine. Laughter is a great way of getting out of, or you know, getting through difficult, painful events.
And can be connecting.
And it can be connecting with other people, exactly. So it really is a double-edged sword. There's nothing pathological about laughter. And we want to, you know, we want to make sure that we understand that. But the problem is that when people are limited by only being able to see they use strategies where they kind of fool themselves, kid themselves that something wasn't painful, then what ends up happening is that when they start to feel the pain of their past, they can't even recognize it. They're like, what's wrong with me? Like, what, you know, what, why am I making it again? Why am I making a big deal out of this? This is a funny thing, you know, and my mom loved me, of course. You know, yeah, she did. Yeah. But, you know, and making excuses and kind of minimizing and that kind of thing. And when that happens again, it sort of precludes the possibility of being able to have the vulnerability needed to be able to engage in an authentic relationship. I had that in my family as well. There's, you know, my my brother tells a quote funny story about this is also interesting. This is also a pet story where we had a pet and my parents ended up giving it back. And this is not it was a pet that that I and my brother were you know, we loved. This was a dog, and we had this dog for a few for at least a week or two, and then my parents gave it back for reasons that I never really found particularly convincing.
Yeah.
But my younger brother tells it as a funny story, but I certainly remember that when it happened, it was not funny at all. It was really, really, really painful. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't by any stretch fault my brother for telling it that way. I think, you know, using laughter is okay. It's important, and being able to sort of laugh at our pains, you know, gallows humor. It's a thing we do. But at the same time, I think, you know, when we think about our trauma clients, there's a certain loss and sadness that part of our work as therapists is helping them get in touch with and connect to, so that they have the ability to feel a lot of different feelings about their personal histories.
Yes. And, you know, you talked about a few minutes ago, you were saying sometimes our own issues get in the way. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about that you talk about in the book, and it's fascinating to me, having recently learned this term before I read your book and experienced it in an experiential training, enactments.
Yeah, yeah.
Therapists, we've all had that moment. You wake up in the middle of the night, oh my gosh, did I do my notes? Well, you don't have to worry about that anymore when you use Therapy Notes. Therapy Notes makes it easy to write your notes, get them done quickly, but thoroughly. My group practice has used Therapy Notes for 6 years, and everyone always finds it easy to use. But the best thing is, if you do need help, you can call their customer service number and a person answers the phone. And anytime I've ever had to use it, which is maybe 3 times in the past 6 years, my issue has been resolved easily with a cheerful demeanor in 15 minutes or less. So I highly recommend Therapy Notes. And don't forget, go to therapynotes.com and use promo code CHAT to get 2 free months. The Institute for Creative Mindfulness is the EMDR therapy training brainchild of Dr. Jamie Marich, a clinician and author who is on a mission to confront stigma around mental health, trauma, and dissociation. The Institute, informed by Jamie's work, teaches a somatic, expressive, bottom-up approach to EMDR therapy that does not treat dissociation like a dirty word. ICM empowers their students to navigate dissociation as a normal response to trauma and stress when it shows up. Dr. Jamie Marich is out and proud on various levels about her own recovery and is a strong believer in the healing capacities of EMDR therapy and helping our clients to heal from the impact of trauma. I and 2 of my team members have been trained by the Institute for Creative Mindfulness directly with Jamie, and I was impressed with how dissociation really was treated as just a normal aspect of trauma therapy work, which it is. Both Jamie and the consultants were matter of fact about if and when dissociation arises, it's okay, it's normal, and here's how you can help the client in that situation. The Institute for Creative Mindfulness is offering a coupon code to save 15% off any program offered by ICM. This includes their EMDR therapy basic training programs and a wide variety of their home study, advanced topics, and other CE offerings. Go to instituteforcreativemindfulness.com and use promo code 15OFF for listeners. There's a link in the show notes. You can copy the promo code and use the link right there in the show notes to make it easy.
We all know that small actions can make a big difference in our lives. I know for me, I can be in a terrible mood, go out somewhere and see a stranger, make eye contact and just smile at them and find suddenly I feel good. Whether it's practicing mindfulness a few minutes each day, movement practices, small actions can have big benefits, like how taking care of your gut can support whole body health.
Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic benefits your gut, skin, and heart health in just two little capsules a day. Your body is an ecosystem, and great health starts in the gut. Your gut is a central hub for various pathways through the body, and a healthy gut microbiome means benefits for digestion, skin health, heart health, our immune systems, and more. Trust your gut with Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic. Go to seed.com/living and use code 25LIVING to get 25% off your first month. That's 25% off your first month of Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic at seed.com/living, code 25LIVING. Can you talk about what enactments are and how they can play into us as therapists?
For sure. So enactments are that space where your underlying attachment issues as a therapist interlock with the client's underlying attachment issues, and something gets played out that you hadn't expected and the client hadn't expected, and it can be blindsiding for people. So, you know, an example is, so a very simple example I gave, you know, let's go back to the case of the fellow who told a story about his mother wanting to abort him. He tells the story as a funny story. You know, he says, my mother tried to, he gave the example of having, you know, he said that he had a good mother. And I said, oh, well, tell me, and what, you know, can you give me an example of when she was a good mother? You know, I just simply asked him, but well, she tried to abort me. Oh, the story's actually cute and funny. You know, she and I we became very good friends later on. And you know, she used to tell me, I used to jump up and down trying to get rid of you. Well, I just thought that was really funny. Can't you just picture that? Her pregnant, jumping up and down. So that's how he tells the story. So he tells it as a funny story. And he's told the story before, and he's told it as kind of a humorous thing. You know, the enactment piece is, how did I get pulled into his telling of the story? How do I get pulled into his narrative? And what about me gets drawn into the situation? So in the book, I give the example of the piece that was, and this is a very small example of an enactment, and there are much, you know, bigger examples, but this is a nice example because this happens all the time to therapists. You know, he's laughing and he's smiling. And I noticed at some point that I was smiling too as he was telling the story. I had this big smile painted on my face. And it's, but here's the weird thing, and I talk about this in the book. I don't actually find that story funny. I actually find it kind of sad and weird and kind of creepy and, you mm-hmm. know, disturbing. But there's a part of me, you know, you might think of it maybe sort of a people-pleasing part of me, a part that's just sort of reflects it, not wanting to embarrass other people. I mean, I don't know. I mean, something about me and my own kind of personal issues interlock with the client's issues where he's wanting to be avoidant. And we together in that little moment are kind of avoiding these feelings. Now, I'm not saying that I avoided it, you know, yeah, at any great length or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, we did eventually come to these issues and through the course of the work. But what I'm saying is that this is a nice example of how something about the client, about the client's history connects with something in the therapist's history, so that the therapist then does something that in some way in that moment undermines the work undermines the work. Sometimes enactments, and that's a very small example, sometimes enactments can lead to all kinds of much bigger problems. An example of where you really see this, and it's actually kind of a problem in trauma therapy, is where, you know, very often it's the case with clients who have trauma histories that they, you know, self-esteem is a big issue for people who have trauma history. They often learn to in fact, be quite, you know, people-pleasing. They want to make people happy. They look for people who are authoritative individuals to turn to help them. Not saying everybody who has a trauma history does this, but there's mm-hmm. certainly a sizable number of people who do this. Because, you know, in some sense, it was dangerous in the home to assert your independence or to voice your opinion, to even have a voice could be dangerous in many people's homes. So to get by, this is a very common sort of thing. We often see with clients who have this kind of profile, a tendency to come into sessions and to turn to the therapist and say, "So, Dr. Muller, do you think I should do this? So, Dr. Muller, do you think I should do that?" Kind of like treating me as their guru, in a sense. Now, if I have something in me that really likes to be needed, that likes to be important to people, that wants, you know, there's a part of me, let's say, that wants to be valued by people, I could very easily fall into playing the role of the guru for this client, the person who has the answers. I could very easily kind of, and we could fall into this pattern of her or him treating me as the expert and me being the expert, and kind of us together co-constructing the space that at the end of the day is not at all growthful to this person. I'm being nice to them, maybe, and they're feeling like their therapist is listening to them and answering their questions. But am I empowering the person? No. Am I helping them find a way to be vulnerable in their life, even though that's a tricky thing to do? No. Am I helping them grow and develop? No. And so, you know, that's where an enactment of some kind, where our two issues interlock, can really be stifling, if anything, to the person, even though on the surface, kind of looks like we're doing therapy, you know, we're, you know, sitting and talking and all doing all the therapy things, but ultimately, no, we're not really doing therapy.
Yes. Yes. So much. And another, I think, easy trap to fall into, and it's not a trap that's being intentionally set by the client. I don't mean that, but just it's an enactment.
Exactly.
When people they feel very disempowered, which is, you know, extremely common for people who have been, particularly people who have been abused in childhood or experienced other situations where they had a loss of power and control. So they present in a way of being very disempowered and seeking, maybe not asking for advice, but saying like, "I can't do this. I need you to do this for me." Or, "Will you talk to this person for me? Will you find this for me and, you know, advocate for me in some way?" When really the person is able to potentially advocate for themselves if they can believe in themselves a little bit more, and we can disempower them by just like, yes, and, you know, thinking, "Oh, I feel so bad for them. There's such a disempowered space. They need me to do this for them," you know, but really, it's like we're believing that they're really as disempowered as they feel as a result of what happened to them, instead of seeing that their power never changed. They just don't know how to connect to it.
Exactly. 100%. Yeah. They don't yet know how to connect to it. They don't yet know how to find a voice. So, and that can be a real challenge. And the example I gave, maybe, you know, where the person's asking questions, but it can be much more subtle than that, where the person is really just sort of, you know, where the therapist, again, inadvertently, I mean, this is not done explicitly, this is done unconsciously, really, ends up kind of taking over and taking charge and trying to fix the person. Again, all motivated by a desire to help and out of love and care, but in the process is sort of enacting what sometimes is called the rescue fantasy. The person is in a sense, the therapist is trying to sort of rescue the person from their trauma history, which, you know, we can help people reach a point where they can learn to grow from and live alongside their trauma, to manage the feelings that come up when they're triggered, and then to grow from the experience. We can help people do that, but we can't turn back time and rescue them from what happened. There are things we can do, and we can do a heck of a lot in good trauma therapy, and it makes a difference in the person's life, a measurable difference that really helps them move on. but we also have to help them be honest about what they went through and integrate it into their story, their life story.
Yes, yes. I feel like one of the kind of underlying messages of this book is to be able to hold like both, that something bad happened and I can be okay now that I'm safe, you know, and but not just that, but there is a big feeling in the book to me of, you know, coming away from that black and white, all or nothing type thinking and knowing that terrible things do happen. And if we survive them, we can grow and be, you know, have wonderful lives. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And we can,
which is a hopeful message for sure.
Yeah, yeah. No, I do have a hopeful message in the book. And I feel that hope for people, and it comes out of my direct work with them. I see it. I see people get better. And so it's an honest hope. It's not a false reassurance.
Definitely.
But where people, you know, get into so much trouble is when they want to leapfrog over the process of recovery and just get to that end point already. And so like, okay, I just kind of want to move on. And that's where, right, that's where people get into trouble, because it is so painful facing the traumas of their past, making sense of them, coming to a place where they're not overwhelmed by the feelings that get raised, noticing and learning what their triggers are so that they can then manage those moments where they do feel overwhelmed, and then also be able to, you know, reach a point where they can then live alongside their trauma. That all is what helps people be able to grow from the experience. The other piece that I talk about in my book that I think others, you know, where I think there's a limitation in work that's been previously done, is the idea of integrating trauma into one's identity. There's recovery from trauma, but then there's also moving beyond the trauma. And I think it's important when people experience trauma to be honest about, or to reach a point where they can more comfortably face the realities of their past without being undone or overwhelmed by them. But then what does that, you know, what is, how does trauma fit into their identity? And with some people, you know, trauma becomes the entire story of their life. I was traumatized. And that's a real limitation when people do that, when it becomes their whole story. Trauma does not have to be the whole story. It's a chapter, and maybe a couple chapters. And they're certainly important chapters, no question about it. But it doesn't have to be the whole story of the person's life. And so we want to help people reach a point where they can find other ways to define themselves, other, you know, where they can sort of in a with more self-determination, find alternate identities, aspects of their own identity. So that's an important piece. Again, without sidestepping it and saying, oh, you know, pretending, you know, without pretending, you know, being honest and but integrating it into their identity. So that's a piece where I think that we don't, you know, we don't see enough in the literature on that. And I think I really wanted to treat the issue of what's trauma's place in people's identities when they've gone through the process of trauma recovery. Where does trauma fit into their life now and into who they see themselves as?
Yeah.
So I wanted to mention.
Yes, it's making me think about something I saw just yesterday. I know you're Canadian, so I don't know if you're as familiar with this, but there was a teenager who was kidnapped. That was a huge sensational story in the 90s here. Elizabeth Smart, she was 14. She was kidnapped. She was found 9 months after she was kidnapped, and the person was prosecuted who did it. And it came into the news recently because one of the kidnappers was released on parole. But in this video, she was saying how people see her as the girl who was kidnapped. And she was saying, that is me, but I'm more than that. You know, that doesn't define who I am, you know, because obviously she was someone before this happened. And she was someone who went through that. And she's someone who has lived, you know, now, I don't know, at least probably 15, 20 years since then, and, you know, carried on with her life. And it sounds like she's done a good amount of therapy. And she's saying, you know, it doesn't define me. It is something I went through. So I think, you know, what you said, it's, and it was, you talk about it in the book in terms of kind of the idea of post-traumatic growth. Yeah. I mean, I don't know for sure if that was how you were defining it, but
Yeah. I think post-traumatic growth is a really important concept that has come into the literature in the last few years. Where we get into trouble with post-traumatic growth is when it's used in a dismissive way.
You yes.
know, don't worry. You'll be fine. You'll grow from this.
Yes.
And boy, there's nothing more dismissive and irritating to people who've been through the ringer than to hear other people who haven't been through those experiences say, oh, you'll be fine. In fact, you'll grow from it. You know, it's
right.
That's really annoying to people. And not just annoying. I mean, it's dismissive. It's,
yes. Invalidating.
It's absolutely invalidating. So you really want to make sure that when you talk about post-traumatic growth, it's not just a caveat, it's a true acknowledgement that in terms of therapeutic technique, you cannot and should not sidestep the validation that's needed in working with people, you know, validating the person's traumatic experiences. What have they lost? And they've lost a lot. You know, when I talked about my parents in terms of,
yes.
In part losing child aspects of their child, or you know, growing up in a way too quickly. But there are other losses that people experience through trauma, loss of illusions about the world. You know, that the world can be a safe place no matter what I do, or loss of illusions. You know, loss of hopes and dreams. You know, people have dreams and then they think, oh my God, how could I have been so dumb to think that a boyfriend can treat you well? You know, I should have realized that, you know. So there's a sort of way in which, you know, mm-hmm. you know, there's the terrible losses that people experience through the course of traumatic events, not just the particular behaviors that happen to them, but all kinds of emotional losses that went along with that. But if the person goes through, you know, no, I shouldn't say, but, and if the person works through those things and acknowledges those losses and experiences them and faces the elemental questions of life and works at this in therapy, what can come for many people is an opportunity to see themselves in new ways, to ask questions, you know, a certain amount, to experience a certain amount of pain. And out of that pain, there's the potential for some wisdom to grow. Not everybody experiences this idea of post-traumatic growth, and you don't have to experience post-traumatic growth in order to have successful psychotherapy. You really don't. Different kinds of therapies look different. But that is something that many people do experience when they've kind of spent a lot of time in therapy thinking about what they've been through and asking themselves, okay, how do I now want to live my life? And what does what I've been through say about me? How do I want to live? What do I want? How do I want to be different? How do I want to have, in what ways has the trauma affected me, and will it affect me for the rest of my life? And in what ways do I want it not to affect me? In what ways am I going to find a voice that speaks against what happened or that responds to that and says, I'm going to assert my own self-determination. I'm going to assert my own voice, and it's going to be different than maybe I was told to live, or that sort of thing. So I think this is part of the process of post-traumatic growth. And we do see it when we have that, we have growth and development. And that's a very nice thing to see when it happens. And it's not rare. It certainly does happen mm-hmm. In trauma therapy.
Absolutely. Yes. I've seen it many times, and I think, you know, the only, as they say, the only way out is through. It's actually much more of a rich experience to live with the awareness of kind of how things really are, and, you know, to be able to have more of a sense of wisdom versus like a, you know, happily ever after type belief about what life is supposed to be like. It's just, you know,
yeah,
that's so limiting.
And I've learned so much from my clients about how, you know, sort of things that in terms of what they've been through, kind of wisdom that I feel very lucky that I've gotten through their experiences. I think, of course, where it's difficult is where instead of wisdom, the pain gets turned into cynicism.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have experienced that, and I certainly don't fault them for that, or even, you know, sit here kind of condemning that. I just think that's a painful place to live. It's hard. It's hard to live in that place, and you know, when you settle on a sort of cynical worldview. And good trauma therapy should help people find something other than kind of just the pain and the loss. It should help them be able to move beyond that, really.
Yes, and it's so beautiful to be able to walk along that path with our clients and ourselves in our, you know, journeys of personal growth and development.
Yeah.
Well, I think your book is your new book, and I'm going to read your other book now, but I think your new book, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up, is going to be very helpful to so many therapists who are working with people who've experienced trauma, and to so many people who have experienced trauma who want to understand more. I feel like it's very relatable for both.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I really appreciate what you're saying. That's really kind of you. And I, you know, when I wrote the book, you and I were talking briefly yesterday on the phone, and I mentioned that I was speaking to, in a sense, two audiences, and they're complementary audiences. They're not disparate audiences. They're really complementary. I was talking to therapists, and I was talking to their clients. So my, you know, very often when I talk about in the book, I say when we, and I use the word we, I'm sometimes referring to the we as therapists, and I'm sometimes referring to the we as clients, we who are survivors, we who have been through struggles and pain and suffering, and don't always know, you know, what to do with those feelings that come up that are really, really difficult, that sometimes blindside us. And then we as therapists who work with vulnerable people who've been through a lot and don't always, you know, feel like we have the answers, but we're willing to sit with our clients, learn from them, you know, share with them some of the things that we've, you know, some of the experiences that we've had over the years and what we've learned from other clients so that we can be helpful to them. And I'm hoping that my book, in a sense, I sort of envisioned an audience of therapists with their clients, you know, with them. And then I'm speaking to people who, so even if, you know, people who aren't necessarily in therapy, my hope was that the book could be useful to them as well.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I really think the way it's written, it's not over anyone's head in terms of too clinical, and it's not beneath, you know, what someone, I consider myself a pretty experienced trauma therapist, and I'm finding many, many resonant points and new, you know, awarenesses and explanations of things that I didn't know how to put into words. So I think it's wonderful. I'm really grateful that you were willing to come on to Therapy Chat today.
I'm really grateful that you contacted me and that we invited me this was really fun. It's really enjoyable for me to be able to talk to people who are like me struggling with kind of just trying to be a better therapist and find ways to help, you know, to help people and to keep improving how we do it.
You've made a great contribution to that. So where can people find your book?
So it's available on Amazon, and if people Google my name, Robert T. Mueller, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up, then they can easily find it on Amazon or other, you know, it's also on the publisher's website, W.W. Norton.
Okay.
It's, yeah, those those places are probably the main ways that people find it.
Wonderful. I will have links to those in our show notes so that people who are listening can click right on it if they want to go to the book and, you know, find you your other book on Amazon, I'm sure, too.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, Dr. Robert T. Mueller, thank you so much for being my guest on Therapy Chat today.
Well, thank you, Laura. I really appreciate it. It was really fun to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for listening to my interview with Dr. Robert T. Mueller, the author of Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up, From Avoidance to Recovery and Growth. I just loved this discussion and I have been so eager to share it with all of you. I'd love to know what you think about it. If you'd like to leave a message, please go to my website, therapychatpodcast.com, and leave a message through SpeakPipe. I love hearing from my listeners. As always, thank you so much for your support of Therapy Chat. Talk to you soon.
Try Therapy Notes, the number one rated electronic health record system available today. With live telephone support 7 days a week, it's clear why Therapy Notes is rated 4.9 out of 5 stars on Trustpilot and has a 5-star rating on Google. Therapy Notes makes billing, scheduling, note-taking, and telehealth incredibly easy. And now for all you prescribers out there, Therapy Notes is proudly introducing ePrescribe. Try it today with no strings attached and see why everyone is switching to Therapy Notes, now featuring ePrescribe. You can get 2 months free by using promo code CHAT at therapynotes.com. Trauma Therapist Network is a website to learn about trauma and how it shows up in our lives and to find a trauma therapist. Go to traumatherapistnetwork.com to find a trauma therapist near you today.
Thank you for listening to Therapy Chat with your host, Laura Regan, LCSWC. For more information, please visit therapychatpodcast.com.